The original position and end result principles. How can it have been supposed that these terms offered by the less well-endowed are fair? Imagine a social pie somehow appearing so that no one has any claim at all on any portion of it, no one has any more of a claim than any other person. Yet there must be unanimous agreement on how it is to be divided. Undoubtedly, apart from threats or holdouts in bargaining, an equal distribution would be suggested and found plausible as a solution. It is, in Schelling's sense, a focal point solution. If somehow the size of the pie wasn't fixed, and it was realized that pursuing an equal distribution somehow would lead to a smaller total pie than otherwise might occur, the people might well agree to an unequal distribution which raised the size of the least share. But in any actual situation, wouldn't this realization reveal something about differential claims on parts of the pie? Who is it that could make the pie larger, and would do it if given a larger share, but not if given an equal share under the scheme of equal distribution? To whom is an incentive to be provided to make this larger contribution? There's no talk here of inextricably entangled joint product. It's known to whom incentives are to be offered, or at least to whom a bonus is to be paid after the fact. Why doesn't this identifiable differential contribution lead to some differential entitlement? If things fell from heaven like manna, and no one had any special entitlement to any portion of it, and no manna would fall unless all agreed to a particular distribution, and somehow the quantity varied depending on the distribution, then it is plausible to claim that persons placed so that they couldn't make threats or hold out for specially large shares would agree to the difference principle rule of distribution. But is this the appropriate model for thinking about how the things people produce are to be distributed? Why think the same results should obtain for situations where there are differential entitlements as for situations where there are not? A procedure that founds principles of distributive justice on what rational persons who know nothing about themselves or their histories would agree to guarantees that end-state principles of justice will be taken as fundamental. Perhaps some historical principles of justice are derivable from end-state principles, as the utilitarian tries to derive individual rights, prohibitions on punishing the innocent, and so forth, from his end-state principle. Perhaps such arguments can be constructed even for the entitlement principle. But no historical principle, it seems, could be agreed to in the first instance by the participants in Rawls' original position. For people meeting together behind a veil of ignorance to decide who gets what, knowing nothing about any special entitlements people may have, will treat anything to be distributed as manna from heaven. Do the people in the original position ever wonder whether they have the right to decide how everything is to be divided up? Perhaps they reason that since they are deciding this question, they must assume they are entitled to do so, and so particular people can't have particular entitlements to holdings, for then they wouldn't have the right to decide together on how all holdings are to be divided, and hence everything legitimately may be treated like manna from heaven. Suppose there were a group of students who have studied during a year, taking examinations, and received grades between 0 and 100 which they have not yet learned of. They are now gathered together, having no idea of the grade any one of them has received, and they are asked to allocate grades among themselves so that the grades total to a given sum, which is determined by the sum of the grades they actually have received from the teacher. First, let us suppose they are to decide jointly upon a particular distribution of grades. They are to give a particular grade to each identifiable one of them present at the meeting. Here, given sufficient restrictions on their ability to threaten each other, they probably would agree to each person receiving the same grade, to each person's grade being equal to the total divided by the number of people to be graded. Surely they would not chance upon the particular set of grades they already have received. Suppose next that there is posted on a bulletin board at their meeting a paper headed Entitlements, which lists each person's name with a grade next to it, the listing being identical to the instructor's gradings. Still, this particular distribution will not be agreed to by those having done poorly. Even if they know what entitlement means, which perhaps we must suppose they don't, in order to match the absence of moral factors in the calculations of persons in Rawl's original position, why should they agree to the instructor's distribution? What self-interested reason to agree to it would they have? Next, suppose that they are unanimously to agree not to a particular distribution of grades, but rather to general principles to govern the distribution of grades. What principle would be selected? The equality principle, which gives each person the same grade, would have a prominent chance, and if it turned out that the total was variable depending upon how they divided it, depending on which of them got what grade, and a higher grade was desirable, though they were not competing among each other, for example, each of them was competing for some position with the members of separate distinct groups, then the principle of distributing grades so as to maximize the lowest grades might seem a plausible one. Would these people agree to the non-end state historical principle of distribution, give people grades according to how their examinations were evaluated by a qualified and impartial observer? I do not mean to assume that all teachers are such, nor even that learning in universities should be graded. All I need is some example of entitlement, the details of which the listener will have some familiarity with, to use to examine decision-making in the original position. Grading is a simple example, though not a perfect one, entangled as it is with whatever ultimate social purposes the ongoing practice serves. We may ignore this complication, for their selecting the historical principle on the grounds that it effectively serves those purposes would illustrate our coming point that their fundamental concerns and fundamental principles are end-state ones. If all the people deciding knew the particular distribution that would be yielded by this historical principle, they wouldn't agree to it, for the situation then would be equivalent to the earlier one of their deciding upon a particular distribution, in which we already have seen they would not agree to the entitlement distribution. Suppose, then, that the people do not know the particular distribution actually yielded by this historical principle. They cannot be led to select this historical principle because it looks just or fair to them, for no such notions are allowed to be at work in the original position. Otherwise, people would argue there, like here, about what justice requires. Each person engages in a calculation to decide whether it will be in his own interests to accept this historical principle of distribution. Grades, under the historical principle, depend upon nature and developed intelligence, how hard the people have worked, accident, and so on, factors about which people in the original position know almost nothing. It would be risky for someone to think that since he is reasoning so well in thinking about the principles, he must be one of the intellectually better endowed. Who knows what dazzling argument the others are reasoning their way through, and perhaps keeping quiet about for strategic reasons. Each person in the original position will do something like assigning probability distributions to his place along these various dimensions. It seems unlikely that each person's probability calculations would lead to the historical entitlement principle in preference to every other principle. Consider the principle we may call the reverse entitlement principle. It recommends drawing up a list of the historical entitlements in order of magnitude and giving the most anyone is entitled to the person entitled to the least, the second most to the person entitled to the second least, and so on. Any probability calculations of self-interested persons in Rawl's original position, or any probability calculations of the students we have considered, will lead them to view the entitlement and the reverse entitlement principles is ranked equally insofar as their own self-interest is concerned. What calculations could lead them to view one of the principles as superior to the other? Their calculations will not lead them to select the entitlement principle. The nature of the decision problem facing persons deciding upon principles in an original position behind a veil of ignorance limits them to end-state principles of distribution. The self-interested person evaluates any non-end-state principle on the basis of how it works out for him. His calculations about any principle focus on how he ends up under the principle. These calculations include consideration of the labor he is yet to do, which does not appear in the grading example, except as the sunk cost of the labor already done. Thus, for any principle, an occupant of the original position will focus on the distribution D of goods that it leads to, or a probability distribution over the distributions D sub 1 to D sub n it may lead to, and upon his probabilities of occupying each position in each D sub I profile, supposing it to obtain. The point would remain the same if, rather than using personal probabilities, he uses some other decision rule of the sort discussed by decision theorists. In these calculations, the only role played by the principle is that of generating a distribution of goods, or whatever else they care about, or of generating a probability distribution over distributions of goods. Different principles are compared solely by comparing the alternative distributions they generate. Thus, the principles drop out of the picture, and each self-interested person makes a choice among alternative end-state distributions. People in the original position either directly agree to an end-state distribution, or they agree to a principle. If they agree to a principle, they do it solely on the basis of considerations about end-state distributions. The fundamental principles they agree to, the ones they can all converge in agreeing upon, must be end-state principles. Rawls' construction is incapable of yielding an entitlement or historical conception of distributive justice. The end-state principles of justice yielded by his procedure might be used in an attempt to derive, when conjoined with factual information, historical entitlement principles, as derivative principles falling under a non-entitlement conception of justice. It is difficult to see how such attempts could derive and account for the particular convolutions of historical entitlement principles. And any derivations from end-state principles of approximations of the principles of acquisition, transfer, and rectification would strike one as similar to utilitarian contortions in trying to derive approximations of usual precepts of justice. They do not yield the particular result desired, and they produce the wrong reasons for the sort of result they try to get. If historical entitlement principles are fundamental, then Rawls' construction will yield approximations of them at best. It will produce the wrong sorts of reasons for them, and its derived results sometimes will conflict with the precisely correct principles. The whole procedure of persons choosing principles in Rawls' original position presupposes that no historical entitlement conception of justice is correct. It might be objected to our argument that Rawls' procedure is designed to establish all facts about justice. There is no independent notion of entitlement, not provided by his theory, to stand on in criticizing his theory. But we do not need any particular developed historical entitlement theory as a basis from which to criticize Rawls' construction. If any such fundamental historical entitlement view is correct, then Rawls' theory is not. We are thus able to make this structural criticism of the type of theory Rawls presents and the type of principles it must yield without first having formulated fully a particular historical entitlement theory as an alternative to his. We would be ill-advised to accept Rawls' theory and his construal of the problem as one of which principles would be chosen by rational, self-interested individuals behind a veil of ignorance, unless we were sure that no adequate historical entitlement theory was to be gotten. Since Rawls' construction doesn't yield a historical or entitlement conception of justice, there will be some features of his construction in virtue of which it doesn't. Have we done anything other than focus upon the particular features and say that this makes Rawls' construction incapable in principle of yielding an entitlement or historical conception of justice? This would be a criticism without any force at all, for in this sense we would have to say that the construction is incapable in principle of yielding any conception other than the one it actually yields. It seems clear that our criticism goes deeper than this, and I hope it is clear to the listener, but it is difficult to formulate the requisite criterion of depth. Lest this appear lame, let us add that as Rawls states the root idea underlying the veil of ignorance, that feature which is the most prominent in excluding agreement to an entitlement conception, it is to prevent someone from tailoring principles to his own advantage, from designing principles to favor his particular condition. But not only does the veil of ignorance do this, It ensures that no shadow of entitlement considerations will enter the rational calculations of ignorant, non-moral individuals constrained to decide in a situation reflecting some formal conditions of morality. Someone might think entitlement principles count as specially tailored in a morally objectionable way, and so he might reject my claim that the veil of ignorance accomplishes more than its stated purpose. Since to specially tailor principles is to tailor them unfairly for one's own advantage, and since the question of the fairness of the entitlement principle is precisely the issue, it is difficult to decide which begs the question, my criticism of the strength of the veil of ignorance, or the defense against this criticism which I imagine in this note. Perhaps, in a Rawls-like construction, some condition weaker than the veil of ignorance could serve to exclude the special tailoring of principles, or perhaps some other structural-looking feature of the choice situation could be formulated to mirror entitlement considerations. But as it stands, there is no reflection of entitlement considerations in any form in the situation of those in the original position. These considerations do not enter even to be overridden or outweighed or otherwise put aside. Since no glimmer of entitlement principles is built into the structure of the situation of persons in the original position, there is no way these principles could be selected, and Rawls' construction is incapable in principle of yielding them. This is not to say, of course, that the entitlement principle, or the principle of natural liberty, couldn't be written on the list of principles to be considered by those in the original position. Rawls doesn't do even this, perhaps because it is so transparently clear that there would be no point in including it to be considered there. Macro and micro. We noted earlier the objection which doubted whether there is any independent notion of entitlement. This connects with Rawls' insistence that the principles he formulates are to be applied only to the fundamental macro-structure of the whole society, and that no micro-counterexample to them will be admissible. The difference principle is, on the face of it, unfair, though that will be of no concern to anyone deciding in the original position. And a wide gamut of counterexamples to it can be produced that focus on small situations that are easy to take in and manage. But Rawls does not claim the difference principle is to apply to every situation, only to the basic structure of the society. How are we to decide if it applies to that? Since we may have only weak confidence in our intuitions and judgments about the justice of the whole structure of society, we may attempt to aid our judgment by focusing on micro-situations that we do have a firm grasp of. For many of us, an important part of the process of arriving at what Rawls calls reflective equilibrium will consist of thought experiments in which we try out principles in hypothetical micro-situations. If, in our considered judgment, they don't apply there, then they are not universally applicable. And we may think that since correct principles of justice are universally applicable, principles that fail for micro-situations cannot be correct. Since Plato, at any rate, that has been our tradition. Principles may be tried out in the large and in the small. Plato thought that writ large the principles are easier to discern. Others may think the reverse. Rawls, however, proceeds as though distinct principles apply to macro and micro contexts, to the basic structure of society, and to the situations we can take in and understand. Are the fundamental principles of justice emergent in this fashion, applying only to the largest social structure, yet not to its parts? Perhaps one thinks of the possibility that a whole social structure is just, even though none of its parts is, because the injustice in each part somehow balances out or counteracts another one, and the total injustice ends up being balanced out or nullified. But can a part satisfy the most fundamental principle of justice, yet still clearly be unjust, apart from its failure to perform any supposed task of counterbalancing another existing injustice? Perhaps so, if a part involves some special domain, but surely a regular, ordinary, everyday part, possessing no very unusual features, should turn out to be just when it satisfies the fundamental principles of justice. Otherwise, special explanations must be offered. One cannot say merely that one is speaking of principles to apply only to the fundamental structure, so that micro-counterexamples do not tell, in virtue of what features of the basic structure, features not possessed by micro-cases, do special moral principles apply that would be unacceptable elsewhere. There are special disadvantages to proceeding by focusing only on the intuitive justice of described complex wholes. For complex wholes are not easily scanned. We cannot easily keep track of everything that is relevant. The justice of a whole society may depend on its satisfying a number of distinct principles. These principles, though individually compelling, witness their application to a wide range of particular microcases, may yield surprising results when combined together. That is, one may be surprised at which, and only which, institutional forms satisfy all the principles. Compare the surprise at discovering what, and only what, satisfies a number of distinct and individually compelling conditions of adequacy, and how illuminating such discoveries are. Or perhaps it is one simple principle which is to be writ large, and what things look like when this is done is very surprising at first. I am not claiming that new principles emerge in the large, but that how the old micro-principles turn out to be satisfied in the large may surprise. If this is so, then one should not depend upon judgments about the whole as providing the only, or even the major body of data against which to check one's principles. One major path to changing one's intuitive judgments about some complex whole is through seeing the larger and often surprising implications of principles solidly founded at the micro level. Similarly, discovering that one's judgments are wrong or mistaken often surely will involve overturning them by stringent applications of principles grounded on the micro level. For these reasons, it is undesirable to attempt to protect principles by excluding microtests of them. The only reason I have thought of for discounting microtests of the fundamental principles is that micro-situations have particular entitlements built into them. Of course, continues the argument, the fundamental principles under consideration will run afoul of these entitlements, for the principles are to operate at a deeper level than such entitlements. Since they are to operate at the level that underlies such entitlements, no micro-situation that includes entitlements can be introduced as an example by which to test these fundamental principles. Note that this reasoning grants that Rawls' procedure assumes that no fundamental entitlement view is correct, that it assumes there is some level so deep that no entitlements operate that far down. May all entitlements be relegated to relatively superficial levels? For example, people's entitlements to the parts of their own bodies. An application of the principle of maximizing the position of those worst off might well involve forcible redistribution of bodily parts. You've been sighted for all these years. Now one or even both of your eyes is to be transplanted to others. Or killing some people early to use their bodies in order to provide material necessary to save the lives of those who otherwise would die young. To bring up such cases is to sound slightly hysterical, but we are driven to such extreme examples in examining Rawls' prohibition on micro-counterexamples. That not all entitlements in micro-cases are plausibly construed as superficial, and hence as illegitimate material by which to test out suggested principles, is made especially clear if we focus on those entitlements and rights that most clearly are not socially or institutionally based. On what grounds are such cases, whose detailed specifications I leave to the ghoulish reader, ruled inadmissible? On what grounds can it be claimed that the fundamental principles of justice need apply only to the fundamental institutional structure of a society? And couldn't we build such redistributive practices concerning bodily parts or the ending of people's lives into the fundamental structure of a society? It is ironic that we criticize Rawls' theory for its fundamental incompatibility with historical entitlement conceptions of justice. For Rawls' theory itself describes a process, abstractly conceived, with a result. He does not present a direct deductive argument for his two principles of justice from other statements that entail them. Any deductive formulation of Rawls' argument would contain meta-statements, statements about principles, such as any principles agreed to by persons in a certain situation, are correct. Combined with an argument showing that persons in that situation would agree to principles P, one can deduce that P is correct, and then deduce that P. At some places in the argument, P appears in quotes, distinguishing the argument from a direct deductive argument for the truth of P. Instead of a direct deductive argument, a situation and process are specified, and any principles that would emerge from that situation and process are held to constitute the principles of justice. Here I ignore the complicated interplay between which principles of justice one wants to derive and which initial situation one specifies. Just as for an entitlement theorist, any set of holdings that emerges from a legitimate process, specified by the principle of transfer, is just, so for Rawls, any set of principles that emerges from the original position by the constrained process of unanimous agreement is the set of correct principles of justice. Each theory specifies starting points and processes of transformation, and each accepts whatever comes out. According to each theory, whatever comes out is to be accepted because of its pedigree, its history. Any theory which gets to a process must start with something which is not itself justified by being the outcome of a process. Otherwise, it should start farther back, namely, either with general statements arguing for the fundamental priority of the process, or with the process itself. Entitlement theory and Rawls theory each get to a process. Entitlement theory specifies a process for generating sets of holdings. The three principles of justice, in acquisition, transfer, and rectification, that underlie this process, having this process as their subject matter, are themselves process principles rather than end-state principles of distributive justice. They specify an ongoing process, without fixing how it is to turn out, without providing some external pattern criterion it must meet. Rawls' theory arrives at a process P for generating principles of justice. This process P involves people in the original position agreeing to principles of justice behind a veil of ignorance. According to Rawls, any principles emerging from this process P will be the principles of justice. But this process P for generating principles of justice cannot, we already have argued, itself generate process principles as the fundamental principles of justice. P must generate end-state or end-result principles. Even though the difference principle in Rawls' theory is to apply to an ongoing and continuing institutional process, one that includes derived entitlements based upon institutional expectations under the principle and derived elements of pure procedural justice and so on, it is an end-result principle, but not a current time-slice principle. The difference principle fixes how the ongoing process is to turn out and provides an external patterned criterion it must meet. Any process is rejected which fails to meet the test of the criterion. The mere fact that a principle regulates an ongoing institutional process does not make it a process principle. If it did, the utilitarian principle would also be a process principle, rather than the end-result principle it is. The structure of Rawls' theory thus presents a dilemma. If processes are so great, Rawls' theory is defective because it is incapable of yielding process principles of justice. If processes are not so great, then insufficient support has been provided for the principles yielded by Rawls' process P for arriving at principles. Contract arguments embody the assumption that anything that emerges from a certain process is just. Upon the force of this fundamental assumption rests the force of a contract argument. Surely, then, no contract argument should be structured so as to preclude process principles being the fundamental principles of distributive justice by which to judge the institutions of a society. No contract argument should be structured so as to make it impossible that its results be of the same sort as the assumptions upon which it rests. If processes are good enough to found a theory upon, they are good enough to be the possible result of the theory. One can't have it both ways. We should note that the difference principle is an especially strong kind of patterned end-state principle. Let us say that a principle of distribution is organic if an unjust distribution, according to the principle, can be gotten from one the principle deems just by deleting, in imagination, some people and their distributive shares. Organic principles focus on features dependent upon the overall pattern. In contrast, patterned principles of the form to each according to his score on a particular natural dimension D are not organic principles. If a distribution satisfies this principle, it will continue to do so when some people and their holdings are deleted, for this deletion will not affect the ratios of the remaining people's holdings or the ratios of their scores along the dimension D. These unchanged ratios will continue to be the same and will continue to satisfy the principle. The difference principle is organic. If the least well-off group and their holdings are deleted from a situation, there is no guarantee that the resulting situation and distribution will maximize the position of the new least well-off group. Perhaps that new bottom group could have more if the top group had even less, though there was no way to transfer from the top group to the previous bottom group. The difference principle thus creates two conflicts of interest, between those at the top and those at the bottom, and between those in the middle and those at bottom. For if those at bottom were gone, the difference principle might apply to improve the position of those in the middle, who would become the new bottom group whose position is to be maximized. Failure to satisfy the deletion condition, that a distribution remains just under deletion of people and their holdings, marks off organic principles. Consider also the addition condition, which holds that if two distributions over disjoint sets of individuals are just, then so is the distribution which consists of the combination of these two just distributions. If the distribution on Earth is just, and that on some planet of a distant star is just, then so is the sum distribution of the two. Principles of distribution of the form, to each according to his score on natural dimension D, violate this condition, and therefore, let us say, are non-aggregative. For though within each group all ratios of shares match ratios of scores on D, they needn't match between the groups. Let the second group have individuals who score half as much on D and have shares twice as large as the corresponding individuals in the first group, where in the first group the ratios between any two individuals' shares and their scores on D are the same. It follows that within the second group, the ratio of any two individuals' shares will be the same as the ratio of their scores, yet between groups this identity of ratios will not hold. The entitlement principle of justice in holding satisfies both the deletion and the addition conditions. The entitlement principle is non-organic and aggregative. We should not leave the subject of the properties of the difference principle without mentioning the interesting, but I think mistaken, speculation of Thomas Scanlon that there is no plausible principle which is distinct from the difference principle and intermediate between it and strict equality. How can it be that no plausible egalitarian principle, short of absolute equality, would exclude great inequalities in order to achieve a slight benefit for the worst-off representative man? For the egalitarian, inequality is a cost, a minus factor. The strict egalitarian doesn't allow any equality at all, treating the cost of an inequality as infinite. The difference principle allows any amount of this cost, provided there is some benefit to the worst-off group, however small. This doesn't treat inequality as a significant cost. I have phrased my comments so that the following principle, call it Egalitarian General Principle 1, will leap to mind. An inequality is justified only if its benefits outweigh its costs. Following Rawls, suppose its benefits are only those to the worst-off group. How shall we measure its costs, and in a way so that they are comparable to its benefits? The costs should represent the total amount of inequality in the society, which might be variously treated. So let us consider as the measure of inequality in a particular system, and hence its cost, the difference between the situation of the best-off representative man and the worst-off representative man. Let X sub W be the share of the worst-off representative man under system X. Let X sub B be the share of the best-off representative man under X. Let E be an efficient system of equality in which everyone gets no less a share than in any other equal system. E sub B equals E sub W. Thus, we get the following first specification of egalitarian general principle 1. Other specifications would use other measures of inequality. An unequal system U is unjustified if U sub B minus U sub W is greater than U sub W minus E sub W, or should it be greater than or equal to? An inequality is justified only if its benefit to the worst-off group, U sub W minus E sub W, is greater than or equal to the cost of the inequality, U sub B minus U sub W. Note that this involves measurement on an interval scale and interpersonal comparisons. This is an intermediate position the egalitarian might find attractive, and it is a stronger egalitarian principle than the difference principle. There is an even more stringent egalitarian principle short of strict egalitarianism, supported by considerations similar to those which lead to the rejection of a simple cost-benefit principle for moral contexts. This would give us egalitarian general principle 2. An unequal system U is justified only if A, its benefits outweigh its costs, and B, there is no other unequal system S with lesser inequality, such that the extra benefits of U over S do not outweigh the extra costs of U over S. As before, treating X sub B minus X sub W as the costs of the inequality in a system X, we get the following first specification of egalitarian general principle 2. An unequal system U is justified only if A, U sub W minus E sub W is greater than U sub B minus U sub W, and B, there is no system S such that S sub B minus S sub W is less than U sub B minus U sub W, and U sub W minus S sub W is less than or equal to the quantity U sub B minus U sub W minus the quantity S sub B minus S sub W. Notice B comes to there is no system S with less inequality than U, such that the extra benefits of U over S are less than or equal to its extra costs. In increasing order of egalitarian stringency, we have the difference principle, the first specification of general egalitarian principle 1, the first specification of general egalitarian principle 2, and the principle of strict equality, choose E. Surely an egalitarian would find the middle two more attractive than the difference principle. Such an egalitarian might want to consider what changes in the structure of the original position or the nature of the persons in it would lead to one of these egalitarian principles being chosen. I do not myself, of course, suggest that these egalitarian principles are correct, but their consideration helps illuminate exactly how egalitarian the difference principle is, and make it implausible to claim it stands as the most egalitarian plausible principle, short of strict equality. However, perhaps Scanlon means that any more stringent egalitarian principle would have to ascribe a cost to inequality, and no theoretical justification has been given which would enable one to ascribe a precise cost. There is one way we should mention whereby even more egalitarian principles might be gotten from Rawls's original position. Rawls imagines rational, self-interested persons behind a veil of ignorance choosing principles to govern their institutions. He further imagines, in the third part of his book, that when raised in a society which embodies these principles, people thereby develop a sense of justice and a particular psychology, attitudes towards others, etc. Call this stage one of the argument. Stage two of the argument would involve taking these people who are the result of stage one and the operation of a society in accordance with stage one principles and place them in an original position. The stage two original position contains individuals with the psychology and sense of justice which is the product of stage one, rather than individuals who are merely rational and self-interested. Now, these persons choose principles to govern the society they are to live in. Will the principles they choose in Stage 2 be the same principles chosen by the others in Stage 1? If not, imagine people raised in a society embodying the Stage 2 principles determine what psychology they would develop, and place these individuals, who are the products of Stage 2, in a Stage 3 original position, and continue as before to iterate the process. We shall say that the iterated original position yields particular principles P if, 1, there is a stage N original position wherein P is chosen, and P is also chosen in the stage N plus 1 original position, or 2, if new principles are chosen in each new stage of the original position, these principles converge to P at the limit. Otherwise, no particular principles are yielded by the iterated original position. For example, succeeding stages of the original position oscillate between two sets of principles. Are Rawls' two principles, in fact, yielded by the iterated original position? That is, at stage 2, do the people with the psychology Rawls describes as resulting from the operation of his two principles of justice themselves choose those very principles when they are placed in an original position? If so, this would strengthen Rawls' result. If not, we face the question of whether any principles are yielded by the original position, at what stage they are yielded, or are they yielded at the limit, and what precisely those principles are. This would seem to be an interesting area of investigation for those souls who choose to work, despite my arguments, within the Rawlsian framework.